Stay hungry, stay foolish.
Now on the Innovation Show, we welcome Nir Eyal, author of Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. Welcome to the show, Nir.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Yeah, so I read your fantastic book. I'm a follower of your blog, and I just thought your work is so important for people working in digital media, innovation. Anybody who's building products today need to understand what you do. So I'm just going to open up the mic to you, man, and just let us know about the process of building habit-forming products.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's something that I thought was very important too. And in fact, my story is that I've helped start two companies that were acquired since then. And after my last company was acquired, I had some free time on my hands, and I was trying to figure out what I would do next. And I just came up with this thesis that habits were really going to matter. This was back in 2012, and I could tell that the trajectory of where things were going were that digital technologies are becoming smaller and smaller. And as the real estate shrinks, meaning the amount of room we have to give people visual cues is decreasing with every shrinking screen size. So when we went from desktops, right, big screens on desks, to laptops, to mobile, to then wearable. And now, in terms of audible interfaces, what we've seen is that the interface has completely disappeared, right? With Amazon Alexa and with Siri, what's happening is that the interface is disappearing. So what that means is if you can't create a user habit, if you can't be top of mind, if you can't be the first to mind solution, you don't exist. And so that means that companies really have to start thinking about how do they form habits? How do they create associations in people's minds so that they become the product that people think of first before the competition?
Yeah, so the human factor has become so important, because when people build products, they think of things and building things, but they forget about the end user and that this needs to be built for somebody, a person, and the value systems of that person at the end of the line.
Right. And also the psychology of the kind of value that even the user can't tell you they need. I mean, that's the thing. I think, a lot of us have smartened up about how to build products, and we no longer just build what the highest paid person, the hippo, says we should build. We don't build what the investors say we should build. That's not how we do things anymore. We do customer development. We talk to customers. We listen to what they need. The problem is, of course, that customers have all these inarticulatable needs, meaning things that they need their products to do, but they can't tell you they need it. Why? Because these needs are these deep psychological needs like loneliness, satisfying boredom, fatigue, uncertainty. Nobody can tell you, I'd really love a product to alleviate my boredom because I feel lonely. Well, that's exactly what Facebook does. Yeah. But of course, a customer couldn't tell you they needed that product.
Yeah, because it's interesting, because when I read your book, I thought also of Clayton Christensen and his concept of what do you hire a product to do? And
right, I was thinking the job to be done.
Yeah, the job to be done. And I thought, that putting your work as a layer on top of that work.
Yeah, I still kind of chew on it. I have the utmost respect for Clayton. I think he's influenced the field so much. I love his work. But I'm still chewing on that concept. It's clear, what's so powerful about that model is, he gives this classic example of people don't want a hammer. They want the hole in the wall that it creates so that they can hang their picture.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So that's why they want the hammer. But then, you even go a step further. Well, why? If you keep asking why, you actually realize that if you keep going enough levels of depth, really the only reason we buy anything is to modulate our mood. It's to provide a psychological relief. What we really want from that hammer is to ease the wanting of the job. Not the job itself, but the wanting of the job, the annoyance of that job not being done. And I think the reason I bring that up is because when you think in that frame of mind, you actually open yourself up to thinking about, well, how else could we satisfy that? Does it have to be a picture on the wall that I hang up with this hammer? Is there other things that might satisfy that person in ways I haven't yet considered? So, I think it's even imperative to go deeper than just the job to be done, but also what's the psychological itch that I'm going to scratch?
Yeah, so asking the right questions. So beyond the hiring, and then and that kind of leads nicely into your framework. So your trigger action reward activation framework that you talk about in Hooked. Can we talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. So the ultimate goal of a habit forming product is to build an association, to create a memory with an internal trigger. Internal triggers are things that prompt the user to action, that tell us what to do next. But the information for what to do next is stored in the user's head. And the most frequent internal triggers are these negative emotions like fear, boredom, uncertainty, fatigue, loneliness. All of these things, we look for relief from these negative emotional states, these what we call negative valence states in psychology. So we constantly look to figure out how to take us out of that discomfort. And we use products and services to satisfy that discomfort. So when I'm lonely, I check Facebook or maybe Tinder. When I'm uncertain, I go on Google. When I am bored, maybe I'll check the news. I'll check stock prices, sports scores. All of these things cater to these painful internal triggers. Now, what we want to do as product designers is to figure out what's our itch and does it occur frequently enough in the user's life for us to attach to. And so the time span is about a week or less. That the more frequently someone uses the product, the more likely they are to form a habit. But really, the cutoff is about a week's time or less. That's how frequently you need people to engage if you want to change their habits. So after we figure out the internal trigger, then we figure out the action. The action is the simplest behavior done in anticipation of a reward. And that could be something as simple as scrolling on Pinterest or pushing the play button on YouTube or a quick search on Google. All of these things are very simple, solitary behaviors in anticipation of an immediate reward. Then comes the reward itself. And typically, it's not just a reward, it's a variable reward, meaning there's some kind of uncertainty, some kind of mystery around what I might find or how this product helps me gain agency and control over an inherently variable situation. We can talk more about variable rewards, the fascinating part of the Hook model. And then finally, the investment phase. This is probably the most overlooked of the four steps of the Hook. The investment phase is where the user puts something into the product to bring themselves back in the future. And they do that by storing value. And this is why I'm so excited about the prospect of technology changing all our lives today, is because, you know, unlike things in the physical world, things made out of atoms like your chair, your desk, your clothing, all of these things depreciate, right? They lose value with wear and tear. But habit-forming products, the miracle of these habit-forming products is that they should get better with use. And that's a really big deal. That's never been possible before. So the more I use Facebook, the more I use Pinterest, Instagram, WhatsApp, Slack, any of these products, either in consumer web or in the enterprise, the good ones get better the more you use them. And that's really amazing. And so that's that fourth principle of the Hook model. The investment phase is what loads the next trigger. It brings the user back and it stores value over time. And that through successive cycles through these four steps, this is how customer preferences are shaped and how tastes are formed.
And then you get to the internalization phase. So when this happens, then it's internalized and it's a habit.
Exactly. So that eventually, what's amazing about these habit-forming products is that you almost never see them spending a lot of money on expensive ads, right? You don't see Facebook and Twitter and Slack and Instagram and Snapchat. You don't see these guys advertising in the Super Bowl because you know they're worth billions of dollars, these companies, and yet you don't really see them spending much money on advertising because they're not changing our minds through ads like the brands of yesteryear would have, like Exxon and Geico and Marlboro cigarettes. The only tool they had was the exposure, right? Using the mere exposure effect to change our preferences. But these companies do it in a much different way. The experience itself is what changes our minds, what forms these habits.
Yeah, and can we talk about the mere exposure effect, just to explain to the audience what that is, Nir?
Sure. So the mere exposure effect is why advertising works. That the more times you see a brand, the more you will like it, for no other reason for the fact that you have seen it before, that you've been exposed to it. This, in a nutshell, explains Donald Trump. For all the prognosticating around why Donald Trump is succeeding, let me tell you, this is why. It's because the public has seen his name, and it's a great brand. I mean, what a great brand to Trump is just such a great brand name. The public has been exposed to this brand name for decades on buildings. You know, there's a reason that Donald Trump understands to put his name as big as he possibly can on every building to watch him on The Apprentice. He, in many people's minds, is a brand that they like simply because they have seen it millions of or maybe hundreds of thousands of times in their life, the same way that we like Coca-Cola over Pepsi, or like one brand of gasoline over the other, or one sports team over the next, is significantly influenced just because we have seen that effect, that brand again and again and again.
It's really interesting because you talk about this actually even for networking. If I'm actually a sales guy or I'm into networking, that I need to go to these events and be seen at those events, because that mere exposure effect happens with people as well. So you're seen at the event, people are more likely, as long as you're not a total jackass, and you're a nice person and you're at these events, you're just your presence and going, oh, that's that guy, and he represents this, that you become a brand in yourself. Yeah.
I mean, in a way, yes. The problem, of course, is that it's not scalable. Right, that you can only go to so many events and see so many people. I think what we see with the internet is that when you use something like content marketing, right? The way I built my business, not intentionally, but what's happened is because I kept writing my blog consistently and sharing my thoughts. Some of them are bad, and I've changed my mind on something. But sometimes I write something that's good and lasts. The fact that the internet can spread good content for me is amazing, right? I get all that mere exposure, for free, essentially. I don't have to pay for advertising. Now, what would be even better than that is to build a product that doesn't even rely on mere exposure. If you think about how all the companies I described earlier, what they do, it's not the exposure to the brand itself that makes us habituated to these products. It's the fact that using it creates a habit, and that's eminently scalable.
Yeah, because I was thinking about the trigger and you know, unbeknownst to many people, those triggers are built into the product. So when you see a little one symbol or two symbol or a little red dot to signify that there's been some action on your social feed or your Twitter, you talk about Twitter and how they're actually built to drag you in and to actually give you a trigger every single time, and push notifications being a fantastic trigger.
Sure. Yeah. So those are examples of external triggers. They tell the user what to do next with some bit of information. So that would be something like a push notification, an email, an SMS, even word of mouth. All of these things are examples of external triggers.
And can we talk, Nir, your background, because it's really interesting. You've set up and you've sold on companies. Can we talk about you for a moment? And because I think it's interesting in that, you know, a lot of startups don't have this psychological understanding of the mere exposure effect, the different triggers, habit-forming products, and your kind of melting pot of bringing that into a startup world or a technical world or a digital media world is really interesting.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So my background is that, you know, I didn't start out as an author. I started out as an entrepreneur and helped start and sold two companies. And, you know, where my experience come from is that in my last company, I was at the intersection of gaming and advertising. So I was constantly looking at these different companies coming and going inside making games and making ads. And, you know, these are two industries that rely upon mind control. I'll be honest with you, right? Advertisers don't spend all that money for their health, and gaming companies know exactly what makes you click and what makes you tick better than you understand yourself. And so that's where I really picked up all this know-how. What was frustrating to me is that I didn't see any how-to guide. I didn't see any manual out there for how do we actually use this outside those industries. And so that's really the guidebook that I didn't find and that I wanted to write, was so that all of us, people building healthy habits, right? How many of your listeners are working on products and services that really, truly could help people's lives if they only use the product?
Yeah, and it's crazy.
That's the problem.
It's crazy because you even see it with medication. People with life-threatening disease or illnesses avoid their medication, and you're kind of going, or somebody who's got, you know, diabetes, or somebody who's obese and is avoiding the gym. Because I thought about this beyond the product, and I thought about it actually from a gym perspective. So even as simple as going to the gym. If you build a habit using your framework, So, you know, and building and stuff like doing it at the same time every day, having a reward like lunch even afterwards, that actually sticks.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's not simple to do. The real, you know, what you want to be careful of is you don't want to make the behavior something that people do only for an extrinsic motivator. Extrinsic motivators are things that have nothing to do with the key behavior itself. So the classic example is that when you tell children that they'll get a reward, they'll get candy if they draw a picture. They tend to draw really crappy pictures because the only reason they're doing it is because they want to get the reward. But the children who do it for the sake of enjoying the drawing actually draw much better pictures. So that's the difference between extrinsic and intrinsic rewards. And so what we want to be very careful of is not to motivate a behavior simply because of an extrinsic motivator. What we want to do is to find something that's inherently pleasurable, right? That's the best. Like socializing, for example, is something that humans love. We have always loved for 200,000 years since our species first evolved. We are social species. So interacting with one another on these social networks is something that we naturally crave and we find rewarding. So that's always the best place to look, is to look for things that people do already offline and then bring them online to make them easier, faster, better.
Yeah, because that is a point I love, Nir, because if you think about corporate culture or any kind of company, and you think about the values or the value systems of those companies or the carrot for somebody to perform, and that's why you see startups so driven, because they're usually intrinsic motivators.
Right.
Instead of like a bonus or, you know, I'm working purely to get my paycheck.
Great point. I mean, if you're starting a business for to be the next Mark Zuckerberg or because you want a lot of money, then you're just bad at math because the odds are horrible that will actually happen for you.
Like, have you any advice for that? So if I'm in a fledgling company and I'm about to scale up, I'm in that fortunate position where I've got there, how to build a company for today's world or today's mindsets that use intrinsic motivators?
Yeah, I think it starts with, you know, a unique perspective that you have. I think the best hack that I don't think people think about enough is that you really need to build something for yourself. That, you know, as you mentioned before, you have to think about your own intrinsic motivation. So if the only reason you want to do a startup is because you want to get rich, that's just a dumb reason to start a company. Your chances are minuscule. However, if you start a product or service because you want the product, right? You are the user. You want the thing that you're going to build. That's a great reason to build a company. That's something that you can do in your nights and weekends. You don't have to quit your job. You can work on that product. You can build it. It's easier than ever to learn how to code, to learn how to design. I mean, all that knowledge is out there. The only thing missing is your will to actually make it happen. So that's my advice, is to, you know, use the competitive advantage that you have of knowing what the customer wants by being the customer, right? You be the user. And if you look at the pattern of all the companies that we admire over the past, you know, 5 to 10 years, Snapchat, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, Slack, Snap, all of these companies were founded by people who follow that formula. They were building products for themselves first.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we did an interview with Dennis Mortensen, the founder of X.ai, and he told me what he does is he keeps a hate list, things that just annoy him so badly that he wants to fix them. And then he comes back to that list. And one of the things was sorting out his inbox, sorting out his diary. And he created Amy and X.ai out of that need. And it's so true, that because you become your best customer, and then you're obviously able to represent the product better than anyone else as well.
Exactly. Because, you know, coming across user insights is so difficult. To try and build a product for someone else, not impossible. People can do it, of course. But if you have the opportunity to build for yourself, I would always take that opportunity first.
Yeah. And so one of the things I thought was really interesting that you talk about is freemium models. So you talk about gaming and obviously your background in that, you know, these 30-day trials, that they all happen to be around 30 days. Yes, it's a month, but also it's the time around it needs to create a habit. Can we talk about that? Because somebody, we have a lot of companies listening to the show who are SaaS products. And the 7-day or the 14-day or 28-day trial, have you any tips around that to build it into a habit?
Right. So the idea is that you want to form that habit. You want to make sure you pass people through the four steps of the hook model, the trigger, the action, the reward, and investment, so that by the time it becomes a habit, now they have to pay, right? This is Slack's story, right? When the more people invested, by when they got through the four steps and ended up with the investment phase and invited other people, connected APIs, then it became something that they needed, right? It suddenly became a painkiller versus a vitamin, and that's the trick. That's why we would want to do this. We want to show people how valuable the product is for a given period of time, and once they form that habit, now it's so valuable to them that they'll be glad to pay.
That's a great line, a painkiller versus the vitamin. I love that. I don't think people really, when I told people about the investment, I don't think they really got that. And I was saying, like, it's like almost like YouTube being user generated content, that the more you upload, it's almost like a network effect. The better it is for everybody on that platform, or it's like Amazon, the more sellers or and buyers you have, the better it is for everyone. That's a type of investment as well.
Exactly. Absolutely. Investment in the network effect.
Yeah. And because there's a couple of pieces of the pie now coming together. We talked about, you know, the Clayton Christensen asked the right questions. We talked about the psychology of what problem you're solving. And we talked about your hook model. And then if you actually add in the network effect there, I was just thinking of a framework. And if you look at those four elements as a whole, and then you just concentrate on, okay, this is my framework, and now I'm going to work on actually creating a kick-ass product, that's a good framework. It's a good starting point.
Sure. I mean, the point of the hook model is to save you a lot of time, money, and heartache building the wrong thing. So instead of, you know, hiring a designer and coding and doing all that work up front, which is what people typically do, they get all excited and start spending a lot of money on stuff. You know, all you have to do is take out a pen and paper, and with this hook model, you can evaluate, look, if my business model requires people to come back on their own, if that's a requirement for my business to stay alive, then do I have the four basic elements of the hook, the trigger, the action, the reward, and the investment? And that's worth its weight in gold, right? If you can look at that and say, oh my gosh, this is never going to become a habit because we're missing one of these four requirements, terrific, great, kill your product, move on to the next thing, and don't waste your life. And if you say, wow, we do pass, there's a high chance here. Okay, great. Now we're going to invest in actually doing some prototyping.
Yeah, and even the investment, like you mentioned, Slack, but it can be as much as uploading data, like so your CSV of your contact base, and then inviting people so they start using it. And it's that kind of thought process as well, beyond your own personal investment. It's actually, as you said, plugging in APIs, that you end up kind of getting so embedded in the product that you can't leave it.
Right, exactly, right. The more you invest, the more it becomes a painkiller.
Yeah, so, Nir, I'm just wary of your time. We committed to 20 minutes. The book is fantastic. It's available on Amazon. That's where I got it. And your blog as well, nirandfar.com.
Exactly, nirandfar.com. Nir is spelled like my first name, N-I-R, nirandfar.com. And actually, if you subscribe to my blog, then I give you a workbook that's a supplement to Hook that kind of walks you through how to build habit-forming products in that free workbook.
Okay, well, Nir, really appreciate your time, and it's been a pleasure speaking to you. Nir EL, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Now on the Innovation Show, we welcome Ronan Higgins and Peter Onk, founders of TV AdSync. Welcome to the show.
How you doing, Aidan?
Hey. So welcome to the show, guys. We'll jump straight into it. So your story, we met actually just when you guys started.
That's right.
And it's a great product, and it's evolved massively. We're going to steer clear of the word pivot, we promised it. But it's evolved massively.
Yeah.
And it's become a product that you've really stumbled upon from the work you started out with.
Yeah.
So we'd love to hear how it happened.
Sure. I mean, I think when we first met was 2 years ago, I think it was, and we were pitching around our basic product, which was and still is based around live TV ad airing information. So we were able to detect when TV ads air and then use that information to trigger short bursts of online advertising. Basic idea is that people were sitting at home watching TV, they had their phones or smartphones in their hands. TV show would cut to ads, the first ad would come up, and then they'd jump on their phone. And if you could just get the same advertiser onto the phone at that moment in time, the power of the TV ad would influence people to click on the digital ad on their smartphone or tablet or even laptop. A lot of people use laptops while they're watching TV. And it was, you know, it's a great concept. And we tested it out, and we got some support from some of the ad agencies here in Dublin to run a control study. And we're able to prove that there was a statistically valid uplift in clicks on ads as a result of doing them within a short window of time from the TV ad. And that was great. That's what we pitched to, I think, a couple of years ago. But as we started to expand out of Ireland and look into other markets, especially the US market, we recognized that the model might not adapt to other markets, especially the US. We were over in New York last April, I think it was April. And one of the agencies basically said, guys, we can see how this works in Europe, but it's not going to work here because the TV audience is spread across a far greater number of channels. And they were right. You know, they were absolutely right.
You might have to explain that the probability of finding somebody in front of the TV watching their smartphone at the same time is quite likely when you have three main channels. But in the US, you have 300 channels. So the likelihood drops down to single-digit percentages of being able to reach the same person.
So scale and fragmentation.
Which affects the probabilities of a person being delivered a digital ad actually being tuned to the right channel at the right time. European markets are good because each market tends to have a dominant national channel. So Ireland especially has RT1, RT2 and TV3, which would command almost 50% of primetime ratings. So you know that if a TV ad airs on RT1 at 8:30 p.m., that 20% of the population have actually been exposed to that ad. And that means 20% of the people who are on their phone, if you give them the same ad on their phone or something relevant to the ad, 20% are actually relevant to the cross-screen experience. Whereas in the States, if you're watching even the primetime highest rating show, you might get a 7% rating. So the statistics just aren't as solid. And for most TV audiences in the US, it's like a 1% to 2% rating, 1 to 2 rating. So the model doesn't make sense. What's the point in buying kabillions of impressions across the whole of the US if you don't have people actually watching the show you're trying to sync against?
Yeah, and it's interesting because on the work involved, I mean, that was no mean task taking on the kind of setup you had to do, because you had to link into the ad serving networks that the agencies would use, because the publisher may use a different one from the agency, he might use a third party one to measure what the publisher is doing.
Yeah.
And to synchronize that is a lot of work.
Yeah.
Like, and you have to know then the ad times, the scheduled times as well. So you need to link into another one. And I suppose it's a kind of a pulling together of all those different platforms that is the product, or was the product.
Yeah, it was definitely technical.
Yeah, it goes actually a step deeper than that. Yes, we did kind of put things together in a very sort of improvised manner. It's like, you need broadcast monitoring, you need to see what's happening on live TV. So we installed servers and put software on them to recognize what is happening in live TV. We started using a demand-side platform to buy ads that were triggered
What's
by...
What's a demand-side platform,
Peter? Oh, sorry, yeah, demand-side platform.
Jargon. Ting.
Enables,
the wrong sound effect.
This is a three-letter acronym, free zone.
We get extra bonus points for throwing in
DSP. Let's throw that in there. I know what it means.
Sorry, I'll explain. Advertisers can buy advertising in real time for online, for mobile devices, for tablets, and one would use a DSP for that. So configure a campaign to target males between the age of 25 and 45 for, let's say, a Gillette ad. And a campaign would be configured to start on the Monday, or the first Monday of a month, and run for a month. And we would kind of do that slightly differently. We configured campaigns to not be running, but only run when a TV ad appeared. So it was just kind of changing the idea of when an ad would appear on a smartphone or a tablet. And at the same time, some competitors started popping up in Germany and in France, and they raised bucket loads of money to roll out across their home market. And their home market, obviously, is 80 million people in the case of Germany, and Ireland is 4 million people. So we didn't have the scale in our home markets, so basically needed to find a way to do it better, which when we went to the US, we did.
Yeah, pretty much. It took a long time to really work out how we would improve the product. But if it was complex, bringing the publishers and the demand-side platforms and the advertising components of the ad tech stack together in combination with broadcast monitoring technology, it suddenly got very complex trying to do something more sophisticated in the US. And we spent about a half a year researching, would it be possible to source or acquire data on a household level that would tell us when a specific household had been exposed to a specific TV commercial? And it's something you might think is kind of obvious if you've grown up in the internet generation, where when you go onto YouTube on your laptop, you know that YouTube knows that you have been exposed to a specific piece of content But in the broadcast industry, that really hasn't existed. There hasn't been a back channel on broadcast. When the broadcaster broadcasts an ad for Ford, they know it's going out to millions of homes, but they don't know which homes. So we were looking for a way to get that kind of data. And we started off by talking to the cable providers, cable operators, or MVPDs, to get your four-letter acronym in there.
Ka-ching.
We were looking at set-top boxes. You know, was there a way that a set-top box might be able to reveal in real time that a specific household had been exposed to a specific commercial? And we knew that set-top boxes had some legacy middleware or technology on them for interactive TV services, the red button stuff you get on Sky in the UK. And in the US, a lot of the cable providers had interactive services. And the more we researched it, the more we just couldn't work out, you know, are these guys capable of sending any signal back up their pipes to some central place or even to us directly that we'd be able to sort of recognize that a TV commercial exposure moment happened? And then, more through fortuitousness than anything else, an old coworker of Peter's happened to have joined a slightly obscure company in San Francisco who pitched themselves as a smart TV interactivity content recognition platform.
Okay.
And for months, we were sort of sitting there looking at the website going, I'm not too sure what they do, to be honest. And then one day the penny dropped and we said, actually, hold on, these guys must be using their recognition technology in the television set to recognize when a piece of content hits the glass. And Peter reached out to his old coworker and said, listen, what are you working on? He said, this is what we're working on.
Yeah. So it turns out that they had built technology that sits in the TV and samples the screen every few seconds to work out what something is, and therefore creating a stream in real time of what a TV is showing on the glass.
So a visual recognition almost, wow.
Yeah.
So we kind of just explored how we could use that, and it turns out that they were building a large infrastructure to work with a number of TV manufacturers that would license their technology to create a real-time stream of what each household is exposed to in real time. So we said, well, that's all fantastic, but what we need to know is when a TV spot airs. Because when you go into content, it's a little bit tricky if you start matching households' data with what somebody is watching. Some people don't want the general public to know that they might be watching something
On telly. So when you say content, you mean programming.
Programming.
The actual show.
And there are different types of programming that people might be nervous about sharing their viewing habits of.
Even though it's completely anonymous. Remember that.
Yes, of course. But what we basically try to work out with them is, can we learn in real time when an ad from one of our clients appears on a TV? And it turns out that that was one of the use cases that they had thought of initially, but never really explored. So we kind of built that relationship over time. And about 6 months into the relationship, we heard a rumor that they were being acquired by the TV manufacturer. And this is, at the time, the number two selling TV brand in the US. So All of a sudden, we were talking to this obscure company day one, and day two, we're talking to this large TV multinational. So it was kind of ridiculously fortuitous, serendipitous, if you will.
That's because it's when you think about getting closer and closer to the distribution pipe, people, yeah, like, I mean, that's where the medium or the gold is. When you think about Facebook, we're publishing, etc. And it's like, we own distribution, we own the customer relationship, essentially. Yeah. And the TVs getting into that just totally makes sense, because people talk about the future of, you know, smarter cars. And, you know, in that world of the smart car, who owns the radio in the car?
Yeah.
The car manufacturer.
Yeah.
The car manufacturer could get into serving their own ads to their own network, especially if you get to driverless cars or autonomous cars, when people are buying less cars and your Halo and your Ubers are driven by AI. Why do you need a car? Do you know what I mean? So it just becomes an on-demand platform.
Yeah.
So they're going to have to replace that revenue stream somewhere. So it's something that totally resonates with me, Peter, is that mindset of getting closer to the customer or a new revenue stream to replace a defunct one.
Well, talking about revenue stream, what had actually gone on with this company? Well, the original company was called Kognitiv. They had the core intellectual property around visual recognition on the glass of the TV set. They got acquired by Vizio Televisions, which was at the time number two. I think they're number one in sales in the US now. And Vizio had been a discount, or has been a discount TV vendor. So they're in Costco and Kmart and Walmart and all the big box retailers, but their business is a very thin margin business. I mean, they think they get a 2% margin out of each TV they sell. So if you're selling a $400 TV, not much actually being made per sale. But it's, at the same time, they're still a $2 billion company in terms of actual scale per year. But they, very soon after they acquired the company that we'd been talking to, they announced that they were going to do an IPO, or they wanted to do an IPO. And their S1 filing revealed that their whole vision for the future and their whole purpose for doing an IPO was that they recognized that there really wasn't that much money to be made in selling TVs, but there's money to be made in having an ongoing revenue stream from a television as a result of the data that it can generate about viewing patterns, viewing propensities, householders, different kind of bits and bytes that you can pull out of it. But in order to do that, the TV had to know what it was actually presenting. And if you think about it, historically, TVs have been pretty dumb. Even smart TVs have actually been pretty dumb. They actually just don't know what they're presenting on the screen. So there's kind of a tectonic change now happening as a result of this new content recognition capability of at least the Vizio TVs. And we approached them saying, we have this business where we help advertisers target online ads to people who've been exposed to TV commercials. Can we leverage or partner with you to license this data so that we can actually do household granular targeting of this to kind of leapfrog our competitors and to bring into the market something that's much more sophisticated and much more in tune with what the agencies want? And they said, yeah. So we've been working with them since April, delivering campaigns into the US market. But even since April, it's now August, almost September, we've already learned that there's a whole slew of other applications that we can actually tap into that leverage this data. And so we're seeing a situation where 50 years of TVs being dumb, now one manufacturer's got really smart TVs in the sense that they know what they're displaying. And here, and now the company's actually going out and doing licensing deals for the tech with other manufacturers who we can't mention. So we can see a situation where we're going to be able to access data from more and more TVs.
Right.
I do need to emphasize at this stage that it's all anonymous.
Yeah.
We don't know who you are or where you are. So we just basically target people based on anonymous identifiers.
Yeah, and from an ecosystem perspective, that totally changes the game. Yeah. Because now you've got a distribution of your own product essentially across by partnership. Because
yeah.
I mean, when we spoke back then, a lot of people didn't understand what you're doing, or they understood that initial product, but they didn't understand how to scale it.
Yeah.
And you guys have just managed through, you know, and you know, you talk about being lucky, but you brought yourself to the table. You were at the table because you had the product. So luck doesn't really exist. You did a lot of hard work, and you know, you rolled the dice for yourselves.
Yeah.
And that's totally changed the game. But it must be frustrating in the early days of this, where you've brought this technology to some companies and they don't know really what you're talking about, because they're probably dealing with the business today as opposed to seeing what it can be tomorrow.
Yeah, that can be frustrating. It's definitely an issue when you're trying to get off the ground as a startup. Most startups have very limited runway and very limited resources, so they have to bring in revenues quickly. And Peter?
Yeah, there's a sort of inaction, and maybe I can say this because I'm not Irish, but in Ireland it might be even worse, but people feel that they're kind of hanging on to their existing business and they are afraid to adjust or adopt new thinking. And that's probably what prompted that pivot on our part, that we just wanted to go and do it elsewhere.
Yeah, and because it's... We see this all the time with innovation, that people are dealing with the business as it is today.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just don't have the right people for the business tomorrow. And people are hanging on to that. And they're kind of going, I don't really want to change because that exposes my lack of knowledge, instead of absolutely jumping and embracing it. And that needs to come from the top of companies and needs to be bred into the companies, that you need to investigate this. You need to get in early.
There's actually another aspect to it, and that is particularly in Ireland is problematic, is that it's really hard to get to a no in Ireland. If you're in the Netherlands or in Germany and you present what you have, somebody will go, yeah, but no.
Yeah.
And here it's that's great. Come back next month.
Yeah.
And then you come back the next month and it's come back in 2 months. So it's just really hard to get to a no. I mean, a no is often even better than a yes,
because
it means you can move on.
And a no with some feedback as to why is
preferably, even better. Yeah.
But like what you want is a Tinder. You want to just be swiped one way or the other. the startup Tinder, that's a great idea. Pitch Tinder.
Innovation dating, yeah.
Yeah. So what's next?
Scaling. So we've found ourselves in the lucky position of being primed for what's becoming a new media product, essentially, and being primed in the leading media market in the world. So there's an opportunity on the table there in front of us. We only have two competitors. We need just to scale into the market and grow with our partners as well. So the next year is all about the US. That being said, we know that some of this capability of smart TV being really smart recognition is coming online in Europe as well. And we're already being asked, because we're Europeans, that's the way we pitch it anyway, we're already being asked, you know, how can we take their products to market here? You know, what kind of revenues can we garner from the European markets? And realistically, the American companies are saying, well, let's start off with the UK and Germany and France. You know, we know they have some decent scale and they're sophisticated enough in terms of their marketing and advertising. And then they look at Scandinavia, which is sophisticated as well. And then they sort of back their way into the Latin countries that tend to be a few years behind the Nordics. So we're kind of looking at focusing on the US, getting the revenues up as quickly as possible, carving out our portion of the market against our competitors, and then expanding the European operation as well.
And is there an opportunity for funding then to fund that scale, or are you okay for the moment?
Like every startup, we're always looking for
always
funding.
Open.
That's just the reality of it. Okay. We did disclose a funding round here in Ireland, supported by Enterprise Ireland as well. Thank you, Enterprise Ireland. But it's just not at the scale that we really need, so we're back out talking to investors. There are a few nice hot irons in the hot fire, so hopefully we'll pull in more funding pretty quickly, actually. And what we've seen ourselves, Peter and myself have actually had a bit of bad luck on a couple of occasions where we've been in the market first, we've had the better product, and we've seen competitors pop up in other markets at bigger scale where the VCs tend to take higher risks and raise the 5 to 10 million euros or dollars and then just take off. And usually it's the first person out of the gate, even if they're not differentiated, they're the first one to get funded, which becomes the differentiator.
Yeah.
They have the war chest. And then when you're second, the first question the VC asks you is, okay, so your competitor has 5 to 10 million in war chest. What have you got that's different that's going to crush them? And it becomes very difficult then. So we're trying to accelerate the process this time around by already engaging with American investors. Especially ones that are familiar with marketing technology, where MarTech is the industry buzzword is happening.
So where can people get in touch for either from a funding perspective or to find the product and engage with it?
With us?
Yeah.
Oh, ronan@tvadsync.com. Yeah. But don't add it to your spam list.
And Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, Peter Onk and Ronan Higgins, co-founders of TV Ad Sync, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So now on the Innovation Show, we welcome CEO and founder of WorkChuggle, Ciara Garvin. Welcome to the show, Ciara.
Hi, Aidan. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so I kind of hijacked you into an interview. You thought you were coming for a cup of coffee.
I thought we were having a cup of coffee, yeah. Yeah.
Well, no better way to... So we're having water instead of coffee, yeah. So I'm a cheapskate. Tell us about the product.
Okay, sure. So WorkJuggle, I'm kind of a very early stage startup. I have a website, workjuggle.com. What I'm trying to build up to is like an online global digital platform whereby companies who are looking for project-based or flexible workings can post their projects and they'll be matched up to a selection of pre-screened candidates who can pitch for the job. So basically, I suppose I'm really interested in kind of the world of work and how that's all changing. And that's why I've been looking into WorkJuggle and launching it.
So what do you mean by the world changing? So what kind of stuff? So AI taking over, you know, rote tasks or what kind of?
Well, I think it's more like if you look around, like, you know, the world of our parents, whereby you worked 40 years for the same company, Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 for your whole life, and you got a lovely gold watch and a defined benefit pension scheme at the end of it. Like, that's gone, you know? And what's going to replace it? And I think to a certain extent, it's kind of good that it's gone because it didn't suit a lot of people. Do you know what I mean? And I suppose what I'd be looking at women as well. You know, it doesn't always suit people for a variety of reasons to be working in that kind of an environment. So I think there's some really interesting changes also in terms of how we present ourselves and how comfortable we are sharing information online. So, I mean, I think 15 years ago, if you had talked about LinkedIn and sharing your CV with your photo and people writing recommendations, I think we would have run a mile. But now it's just part of our lives. It's what we do and it's how we sell ourselves. I also think technology has really moved on. So now, and I mean, I've done it myself and you've probably done it as well. Like, I have managed a project go live in my sitting room in Dublin with support from India, which is going live in Redmond, you know, in Redmond, Virginia. So like the requirement to be someplace has really changed. And I think that's a really interesting space as well. And also when you look up and you look at the new workforce that's entering, and we talk a lot about the millennial workforce and all that, and I actually think they're great. You know, I really admire the way they're so values driven and experience driven. And I think for them, the thought of having like that kind of a 40 years for life in the same company, I think that's horrifying for them. And I think they're looking to move and change. And particularly people who have like really highly in demand skill sets, there's an, you know, there's opportunities to do that now.
Yeah, it makes sense. We had Kingsley Aikens on the show before as CEO and founder of Diaspora Matters. And Kingsley talked about this and he said, my children will have probably 18 different jobs. And
yeah.
He said like, so it'll be 2 year jobs. It'll be project-based work.
Yeah.
It will be flexible work.
Yeah.
And just some companies like Catawave, where I work, and we're working towards a four-day work week.
Brilliant.
And it doesn't mean that's skiving off and having an extra day. It means actually getting your work done in a much more efficient way, using technology to help you get there. And that's why, like, I use Amy, which is an artificial intelligent agent to manage my diary.
Brilliant.
It saves about 3 or 4 hours a day a week, which is, you know, and if you can imagine if I had a lot more meetings, how much time that's saving me. And there's a huge shift towards the world being on demand almost. So it's like a Netflix world. It's like I watch it when it suits me. And the other thing is like I had Dr. Pauline Kogan on the show. We're talking about education. We're talking about how the education system doesn't cater for the way everybody learns differently. And learning difficulties aside, some people are visual learners, some people are memory learners, and some people are immersive learners. And the world has adapted to that, finally.
Yeah.
Well, it hasn't really, it hasn't got near where it should be, but it's exactly the same as the workforce. And you've identified that as a problem that needs to be solved.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I suppose what kind of started me on all of this as well was, you know, like many people, you know, you're working away, you know, I've worked in large corporations and it's great. But then let's say you have, you know, your third child and you're looking for other opportunities and you say, God, you know, I'd love to work somewhere just 3 days a week. You know, I think that's what I could do at the moment. But to try and find those organizations that are going to offer you a 3 day week, I think it'd be easier to like Google US military installations. Like that information would be more readily available. So what I'm trying to do is let's celebrate those companies that have this really great culture. Let's celebrate those companies that are really, they're not just have like innovative over the door, but actually we are being really innovative in how we're working. And we are really looking at our workforce and our gender diversity. And we're really, and those companies are out there. You know, now I'm out, I'm talking to companies and you're starting to see actually, yeah, some people are really far ahead. So let's celebrate them so people know and people can then move accordingly to where those really interesting jobs are.
Yeah, it's because it's interesting with the shift in Ireland. So we've seen, like sometimes I'm envious of startups, you know, because they're not only have they got a product that's relevant for today, they have set the company up with a workforce that's relevant for today and workflows that are relevant today. While there's so much legacy, and you know, think about the newspaper industry, and they're almost labored with the printing press.
Yeah.
And nobody, you know, the printing press is in huge decline. But it goes deeper than that because there's organizational structures and silos in place that were fit for yesterday's world, maybe.
Yeah.
But today's world just doesn't work that way. It's open, it's collaborative, it's innovation. It's innovation as part of the culture of the company, and it's inbred into people, and they just don't see it because it's actually the culture.
You know, and that's so interesting. I just did a review actually on Irish Tech News of Gillian Tett's The Silo Effect, and she's talking about how dangerous it is if you live in a silo. You know,
the octopus pots.
Yeah,
I did a post on it a few weeks ago.
Okay, yeah. No, it was a great book, but like the financial catastrophe of 2008, everyone is doing their job to the best of their ability, but we're all marching off a cliff, you know? And that's why I think it's very important to get different viewpoints in and different ways of looking at things. And, you know, whether that's neurodiversity, whether that's somebody who's coming to the workforce from a different organization, it keeps everything fresh. But I think the challenge with something like WorkJuggle is it absolutely has to work for companies as well. It has to be company focused in terms of people have to be coming in with those like high in-demand skills. you know, really hitting the ground running, and it has to work for everyone.
So in a way, work juggles like a matchmaker. So
yeah, a little, yeah.
Demand and supply
side.
Yeah,
exactly. And you know, it's so interesting because I think sometimes in London they're a bit further ahead, and they're saying like, if you advertise a job flexibly, the level of qualifications coming in the door, it just flies up in terms of people all of a sudden are looking at it who maybe wouldn't have looked at that job. So oftentimes you're getting in somebody who's possibly like really highly skilled, but they're looking for that little bit of flexibility. But I think like I'm at a really early stage, and I know I've said that to you before we started,
absolutely.
Like, you know, like I have my website, but it's very much like, you know, I built it myself, you know, it's really, I've just finished New Frontiers phase one, hoping to get on to phase two, and just really kind of getting a feel for the market and what's out there. But so far, everything's been really positive.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've certainly hit upon a place that's untapped, I suppose. And let's use this opportunity to put out there what you want. So what's your next step? So you've done New Frontiers. Is it to build a team? Is there any funding to build a team?
Yeah, I suppose I'm kind of, you know, I suppose I am like a techie. Do you know what I mean? In terms of like, I was in Bolton Street doing computers like 15 years ago when it was like the least cool thing you could ever do, you know? And like...
Nerd.
Yeah, totally. And like there were three girls in the class. It was like, you know,
yeah,
and we
totally
were all
different.
Complete nerds. Like,
yeah, yeah.
But... And so now it's kind of funny because technology is all really cool. Mm. And so I suppose where I see my side is definitely, you know, I love the technology. And what I'm looking to do is I've really started learning a lot about the finance side and how important that is in terms of like really ramping up your growth, you know. And I've been learning a lot about funding. And I think that's where I'm going to be concentrating going forward, is trying to get a couple of funders on board who can really see like the huge potential here, you know? And I think Ireland as well, Ireland's in a great location because we have all these great multinationals here. We have the highest childcare costs in Europe. So, I mean, there's a real, you know, that's a real pain point here. And we have some really good EU laws as well in terms of whereby people, like my brother-in-law works a four-day week and nobody bats an eyelid anymore. Do you know what I mean? Like, so I think we have this really interesting mix of culture, legislative, financial pain point that could really spread from Dublin.
Yeah, and it's interesting you said about your brother there, because like I always found this fascinating that I could come in at 7 a.m. Mm-hmm. or I could work till 7 p.m. and come in at 9:05, I'd be like,
I know,
past nine,
I've
been here. I'm here till seven.
And
I think that's an old school mindset.
It is an old school, but it's interesting. You know, I was out working on contract over in Microsoft there last year, and they had a brilliant, you know, I mean, lots of people worked remotely. I mean, every department is different and all that, but like literally people came in at 5 a.m, people left at all sorts, but like we were all working
focused.
Strong hours.
Yeah, yeah.
But being at your desk just wasn't important. And it's one of the few places I've worked where people have said, you know, it's not important to be at your desk, and then really followed up like, you know.
It wasn't just lip service. Because there's a really interesting point in that I found, right, from experience, mm-hmm. that when a mother comes back from maternity leave, mm-hmm. that they are so focused and so like they cut out all the crap.
Mega efficient.
Yeah, I think they're brilliant. And they're,
yeah, yeah.
Because I suppose from experience, when you have children, your life gets broken into 20-minute segments. Like, I have 20 minutes. Don't waste my time. God damn it. And, you know, you see that coming into workplace and it's kind of going, do I really need to meet? No, you don't. And that's brilliant. The workplace needs more of that. Meetings for the sake of meetings and meetings about future meetings is still in a lot of companies. And you're kind of going, imagine you didn't have to go through all those meetings. And it's like all I want to do is touch my toes. And you're going, here's a fat suit. Now try and touch your toes and with the meetings. And it's killing you. And, you know, I really do find maternity mothers who come back from maternity mm-hmm. leave just really, really phenomenally focused.
Yeah.
And I think like work juggle can facilitate that in the future.
Absolutely,
because I suppose, you know, if they've changed roles or they're kind of going, you know what, I don't want to do the 5-day week anymore.
Yeah.
3 days week is it more effective for me.
Yeah.
Because again, like there's a lot of FaceTime in businesses where they don't need to be there 9 to 5, but the company's kind of going, well, that's the way we do it.
Yeah, yeah. And I do think, and so again, like I was talking to Dell there recently. I mean, they had a great program for people coming back, and it does make such a difference in terms of having that level of support.
We talked about funding. We talked about the problem, your team that you need to put together. So do you need a team of coders or developers?
So I'm actually, I suppose, because... I'm very happy with like the outsource model. So I've talked to, because that's what I'm used to, is like not necessarily working with people side by side on a desk. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
that's just the way IT has gone. That generally your team is not in Dublin. So I've talked to a couple of internet companies in Dublin that I think would be really good to build it. And I'm really happy to go with them. And at this stage, I'm just looking for funding just to bring it up to the next level a little bit. And I, that's why I suppose I'm kind of waiting to hear back on New Frontiers Phase 2. And just like, I really just think there's just such a huge opportunity here.
Yeah.
And it's not just for candidates, but also for employers, because a lot of times, I mean, Dublin, like particularly the tech environment, like it is really competitive, you know, like I have been hiring people in, and we're hiring people in from abroad, even when there's like high unemployment here in Dublin, you can be really, because you want a specific skill set. So, and I think also in startups, you know, they're coming up, they have a requirement, but maybe they can't afford, you know, to hire somebody on a full-time basis. So yeah. I just think there's this really interesting space at the moment whereby you can really help out employers and the candidates coming through.
So last question for you. So New Frontiers program. So what was, how was that like? Like, and well, how did you get, how did you start?
Well, I suppose I put in my application. It was recommended to me. And I actually went down and I did it in Maynooth and Athlone. Like I live in Dublin, but they were really kind and they said they'd have me. And I commuted down there to do it. And I just found it great because I love, like there are so many people in the room with really cool business ideas, with loads of energy, who really want to make it happen. And then just to, you know, and then people who are really happy to facilitate you making it happen. Like, it's fantastic. I mean, like, I know for me, like, I've three kids, you know, sometimes it can be hard for people to understand why you would want to take the risk. That's what I find. Like, people, like, often say to me, you're mad. You're mad. Why would you do this? You're completely mad. Would you not just retrain and be a teacher, or you know what I mean, like there's all this, or you know, oh, you're too nice to do that, you know, why would you do the hassle, why would you take that on yourself? Whereas when you go and do something like a New Frontiers program, everybody is like, yeah, that's the best thing you could ever do.
Same page.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Everyone's like, yeah, that's so cool, go do that, you know. And I just think for me, and I think for the others in the room, like you just get so much out of that energy. And like, the only thing is you can just see like their ideas, like there's some great ideas and there's great drive, and you just really want everyone to succeed.
Yeah, that's great. And it's kind of birds of a feather.
Yeah.
You know, and that energy, I suppose, is just like, I've been in those moments, and you know, in bigger companies, you put a hackathon together and you put, where everybody's energy is pointed in the same direction,
yeah,
it's just magical. And that's yeah. what, and you're going back to what we you talked about, Gillian Tett and the silo effect.
Oh, yeah.
Like Sony's total failure was due to everybody's energy was pointed in different directions and yeah. where the silo directed. And when that does come together in the right place, that really can be magical. So next steps for you is, hopefully, New Frontiers.
So at the moment, yeah, and at the moment I'm busy working away and getting funding, and I actually have a potential investor who's interested, and I'm kind of learning on my side on the whole financial side. So, and I'm talking to companies, and I'm really interested in talking to companies who are doing it well. You know, I'm all about like, let's celebrate those people who are doing this well.
Okay.
And I'm meeting Pioneer on Monday, you know, like there's just like Dell have been really supportive to me. You know, there are companies doing it well. So let's give them a forum.
Yeah. And so how can people get in touch with you, Kira?
Sure. Well, workjuggle.com. That's where I am. Kira@workjuggle.com.
And on social?
And yeah, on Facebook and on Twitter as well.
Okay. Well, Kira Garvin, CEO and founder of WorkJuggle, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.